Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and I discern that we have a theme for today's program.
We do.
Which is called Italian.
Italian and Italy and good things Italian. But interestingly, all three guests are actually residents of these United States and simply have a background in their native land of several generations ago in most cases. Which is why we brought them together into this program. And first up, a name that would be familiar to diners around the world, if they follow the very best in dining criticism, and is it Esquire or GQ? Esquire magazine?
Right. And he's the author of, this is his 12th book, so he's been writing a while.
He's been writing a while, and books too, and he writes something frequently on the subject of food, often controversial. And nothing more controversial, I guess, than how Italian food conquered the world.
I really don't know of another restaurant critic or traveler, you do both, as well-known as John Mariani from Esquire. Do you think that's true? Maybe Ruth Reichel, John. What do you think?
Well, I would say that Ruth, myself, maybe Coleman Andrews, and my competitor over GQ, Alan Richman, we do get around many, many cities here and abroad to eat, which most restaurant critics and or food writers just don't have the wherewithal or the time to do. If you're a daily or weekly critic for the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune, you never get out of Chicago or New York, whereas I get to about 20 cities a year in the United States alone.
And have you noticed any change in dining scenes in some of the sort of smaller markets?
It is amazing to me. In the last 5 years, I have been to cities like Greenville, South Carolina.
Oh, we were there, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, Providence, Rhode Island, Austin, Texas. I mean, these places are not just booming with new restaurants, but these have chefs in them who have worked at the best restaurants in the United States and the world and bring that back to these smaller markets. And the people are just as sophisticated, their customers, to really appreciate what good food is. They're making their own charcuterie. They're making their own mozzarella cheeses. They're baking their own breads. It is just nothing short of remarkable.
Right. Well, I think so, too. What we're supposed to be talking about, though, is your new book. How many books have you written?
I think this is the 12th.
Wow. Anyhow, this one is called How Italian Food Conquered the World, and it's has a foreword by Lydia Bastiani. That's a good credential right there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lydia's amazing. I don't know how many books she's written. But now, basically, what you're really talking about is a short development of Italian history, culture, and food, and then how that was exported to the USA, right?
Well, and the rest of the world, too, I guess.
Well, early on, however, we're in the period that you're talking about, the immigrant period of the late 19th century, overwhelmingly Italians did come to the United States. Some few thousand might have moved to London, some might have moved to France, but 5 million Italian immigrants, almost exclusively from the south of Rome, Naples, Campania, Calabria, Sicily, those are the ones who came here and created this thing, this amalgam called Italian-American food, which was based on bigger portions, more access to meat that they ever could have dreamed of, having pasta several times a week, which these poor people could never have dreamed of. And it was that, and pizza, of course, which comes out of Naples, which became an American phenomenon that was unknown to Italians outside of Naples until well after World War II. So, yeah, as I pieced together in the book a story that while the food in Italy continued to be much better, finer, and more regionally exacting than anything we had in the United States until the 1980s, things have really changed since then because of fashion, style, much, much better ingredients they never had access to, and the Mediterranean diet. All of those things conspired to make this once heavy, gloppy cheese and red sauce cooking a real fine cuisine that the whole world has embraced at this point.
Well, you could say that about Chinese food, too, right?
Well, you know, it's curious. The Chinese food, you can certainly find Chinese restaurants in Paris, and you can certainly find Chinese restaurants
in Italy.
In Italy, but I can't imagine anybody going to Rome or Tuscany or Sicily and saying, let's have Chinese food. Whereas in Paris, I'm going to be in Paris in a couple of weeks, and they just opened a new hotel there in which they have a fine French restaurant. They've also installed an Italian restaurant.
Uh-huh.
And this is becoming quite common. Alain Ducasse was one of the promoters of Italian food 15, 20 years ago. He was the first one, because he's in the south of France, in Monaco, to use olive oil and to make pasta. And to, of course, the French have to stuff ravioli with foie gras in order to make French shower it with black truffles. Chinese food is certainly ubiquitous, but it is not the power and the enormity of interest and popularity that Italian food has in the rest of the world.
Now, it's interesting, John, that as you start off in the book, it doesn't really look like Italian food's going to win.
No, it doesn't.
It's a really long story, and you have to get a fairly long way into the book to come up with an Italian cuisine outside of Italy that you would consider satisfactory at all. You're pretty tough on people, like you should be. And the result is a lot of comments which aren't uniformly positive, shall we say.
Well, only the first chapter deals with the first 2,000 years of Italian food, because, as I say, there really wasn't anything you could call Italian food before the 19th century as something Italian, because there wasn't any Italy until it was
exactly.
United. And then I'm surprised that you think that I was negative about the Italian-American experience, because I find that that was indeed, it was a certain type of peasant cooking that didn't rise to the heights of grand French cooking, but by the same token, it was well-developed, it was increasingly based on good ingredients, and imported tomatoes and imported cheeses. But you're absolutely right that it took a long time for it to get any real credibility, not until well after World War II. Because the Italians themselves were, for most of those 2,000 years, the Italians themselves were pretty close to the poverty, certainly the almost starvation level. And the landlord system was not broken until the early 20th century. So to think of Italians as eating with abundance all the great stuff that Italian-Americans had every day.
You're talking about the sharecropping scheme.
Yeah.
That really governed the way that most land was worked, correct?
Yes, exactly. You'd have a landlord, usually the rich man who lived on the hill in the mansion, and he would rent out the very land that the peasants worked. I mean, they had a meager income, and then they would sell the fruits and vegetables and the sheep and everything to the landlord, who would take them and then sell the bad portions back to them, which is why a lot of Italian food is based on offal, sweetbreads, and liver, and kidney.
That's true of any peasant cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? When we were in Abruzzo, they used to have these, they do have these plaques in these little towns we went to, announcing how many people that they lost, young men who emigrated to the United States from their town. It was so sad.
Well, my grandparents on my father's side are from Abruzzo, and I visited their town, which if you visit it today, it's called Vasto on the Adriatic, and it's lovely. It's charming. It's not overly elegant, but it's lovely.
It's well south, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were there. There was some kind of, it was difficult to get through the town because they were having some kind of parade. It was some kind of festival.
They always have festivals.
But it seemed like a really charming town and a very handsome one too.
Well, I mean, I visited the town where my ancestors came from in Vicino Palermo in Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a beautiful town too. But there weren't any jobs, and people were starving, so
everyone left. Right, and this is absolutely right. When I went to Vasto for the first time, they had an exhibition in the local church or exhibition hall of what it looked like in 1905 when my grandfather exited.
Mm.
It was grim. It was very, very grim. And as you say, there were no jobs. The Industrial Revolution largely passed by Italy, and these people were very, very poor, and America offered them a way out, so much so that, as you indicated about the names, that they say who left, it kind of depleted Italy of males, which is why in these, when Mussolini came to power, especially after World War One, when the Italians lost even more males, Mussolini would pay women to have more and more and more children because they just needed the population.
Now, you go into sort of the history of certain ingredients. Can you give me a definitive, where, because Peter asked me that right away when I was reading the book, who gets the credit for pasta?
Well, the word pasta just goes way back to, it just means paste, any kind of paste.
Right.
You would make cookies or cakes or anything. So the word pasta was really not used with relation to spaghetti and macaroni, and it was mostly macaroni and vermicelli. These were pretty close to the first pastas that the Italians were making. And they, by the way, they were making and cooking pasta before Marco Polo.
Okay, that was everybody.
This was really the question that I was driving at.
Yeah. Well, what happened was that Marco Polo came back from the Orient of 14 years, and he said, the Chinese are so far ahead of us, and in every respect, and including economically, but that he also noted that they were eating noodles just like the Italians have been eating noodles for 300 or 400 years. Nobody seems to notice about Marco Polo that he actually did bring back rice to Italy, which was unknown at that time.
I said they didn't have rice. That's interesting.
No.
Now, there are dozens and dozens. I Googled this subject, dozens of books about this. What motivated you to tackle this subject again?
Well, frankly, you're right that there are many books about Italian food, but none of them actually brings it up to the 21st century. One of the best, which is called Delizie, Delicious, written by a British author, is a wonderful book which I drew on, but largely he speaks about Italian food in the Renaissance and up until the 19th century. He does not treat of what happened to Italian food in the 20th and 21st century, when in fact it did conquer the world. And he doesn't discuss at all the immigrant period, which is crucial, absolutely crucial to changing and Italian food evolving. The whole idea of the red sauce comes from the southern Italians who brought it here. Nobody north of Rome would eat a tomato because they thought it was poisonous.
Tomato, right?
Came from America. So it was only in the late 19th century that the Neapolitans started to shift canned tomatoes northward that it began to get some traction north of Rome. So that even today, I was just in Turin and Venice about 3 weeks ago, and over a two-week span, I never saw a tomato sauce.
Yeah.
I grew a lot of pizza, which is on every corner now, but I didn't see any tomato sauce.
One of the things that I perked up at reading your book is I just never figured this until we were interviewing John Besh about his New Orleans, that book. And I got to the section with all the Italians. I mean, stuff that I grew up with, he had recipes for in there. And I didn't realize there was such a huge settlement in New Orleans of Italians.
Well, it was mainly Sicilians, almost exclusively.
Which is my background, so that's why I know these things, the recipes.
Yeah, and the Sicilians, they came largely because after the Civil War, the former slaves did not want to work on the plantations anymore. They didn't want to pick cotton, and they didn't want to pick fruit. And they noticed that the planters and the farmers noticed that lemons were coming in from Sicily, because it was slapped on the crates and it said from Palermo, from Sicily. So they said, maybe these people would pick the stuff. And that's exactly how it happened. So the Sicilians poured into New Orleans and Louisiana. They went out and eventually dominated the strawberry plantations and made millions of dollars that way. They brought ice cream to New Orleans. So that I was just there a couple of weeks ago, and they said, you know, it really should have been called the Italian Quarter, not the French.
Exactly. Now, you just introduced another subject, which I found very interesting. There's a number of industries in this country that are indebted to Italians. And also, tell us some of the prominent, people who came, made money, including in San Francisco, you have a number of them. Could you just, for our listeners, go through some of the Ghirardelli?
Sure. I mean, Ghirardelli's chocolates out of San Francisco, the Italians, especially in Piemonte and in cities like Turin, were the master chocolate makers of Europe. And they brought that idea and their expertise to the United States in that regard. They also, as I mentioned before about the canned tomatoes, had enormous amount
cannery.
Of experience with canning. So they became, you know, like contadina products. And that was Italian.
And you never think of that until you're reading it, and all of a sudden, why didn't I realize that the contadina was an Italian?
Right. And then, of course, grapes and eventually wine. I mean, the whole California wine industry was basically almost entirely Italian from the late 19th century. And even people like Robert Mondavi today and Tedeschi and many, many others, Martinelli, Petroncelli, I mean, these were all Italian names. So, yeah, they came to America to use the skills they knew as contadini. Well, contadini basically means a peasant farmer. That's where the name contadina for the canned goods comes from.
Right.
And whatever they were doing back there, including stonemasons, one of the interesting things is here where I live, down the Bronx, we have a Little Italy section, which is much bigger than the Manhattan one. And the reason the Italians moved up to that section was because the Bronx Zoo and the Botanical Gardens needed stonemasons. So tailor-made for Italians. So they settled up there, and it is to this day one of the great Italian missions and markets in the United States.
It's a street up there that has all the Italian restaurants on it. There's one particular street. I forget the name.
Arthur Avenue, right.
So I used to call on Montefiore Health System there. The person that I talked to loved to have dinner at places on Arthur Avenue.
Well, it's not easy to understand why it's called Montefiore Hospital.
Right. You got it.
Because, you know, it's also called the Belmonte section. And if you recall, the earliest doo-wop songs were by Dion and the Belmonts, who lived on Arthur Avenue.
Oh, no kidding. Now, the other thing you do, in addition to going through the history of the development of Italian cooking and then Italian restaurants and bringing that very much up to date, for which everyone should be grateful. You do the same with the story of Italian wine.
Yes.
Which is a parallel story. Again, suffering from the sharecropping approach to working the land, where the peasant growing grapes didn't have any incentive to grow quality grapes, but he did have an incentive to grow as many as possible.
Yeah, and I mean, they never knew what grapes they were. They literally, because the grapes, like any plants, can migrate and trans-pollinate, so to speak. And so they were just working with whatever grapes were there. This was not a person who looks into the biology of grapes, who call an ampelographer. And ampelographers didn't bother to look at this until the 20th century. So the wine was destined not to be particularly good. Certain soils were better for some grapes than others. But also what we forget is that, and this is true even of France and certainly of Spain and Portugal and elsewhere in Europe, that 99% of all wine was bulk wine put in barrels. And you'd bring your bottles or your flasks to the winery and just load up whatever they had.
Yeah, we did that. We did that any number of times.
Yeah.
We did this in the, where were we?
We were in Puglia.
We were in Puglia. And it was like a gas station. You got this big jug, and I kept saying to Peter, isn't this really wonderful for $2.40? But it was absolutely undrinkable.
Well, imagine you tell the story of long-lamented Riuniti, and it's interesting, and you talk about the Bolla family.
Yeah.
We just interviewed the enologist for the Consorzio de Soave.
Soave
is finally recovering its proper place among white wines.
Well, I will credit Bolla specifically, and Banfi was the ones who brought in Riuniti, and they became some of the greatest importers of the finest Italian wines, like Brunello di Montalcino and others. But I will say that Banfi, they produced basically good bulk wine from the Veneto, Suave, Bardolino, and Valpolicella. And they had these beautiful romantic ads back in the 1960s and 70s, which was the first ads to give Italian wines an image above the Chianti and that it had ever had. Before those ads, you had Riuniti on Ice, It's Nice. It was basically soda pop with some alcohol.
That was really disgusting, yes.
Yeah. And then, which by the way, still is one of the best-selling wines in the world.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah. But Bolas, they really were Suave and Bardolino and Valpolicella at that time, and they were dry. They were among the first dry Italian or European wines to come into America. Prior to that, Americans liked sweet wines.
They still do, I think. But
yeah.
Now, John, so we want to remind our listeners, it's called How Italian Food Conquered the World by John Mariani. And John, while I have you on the phone, I wanted to ask you how you've perceived, because you've been at this for a long time, what's actually happening to restaurant criticism in this country with the Yelps and the, you know.
How long do we have to speak about that?
Yeah, I know, not too.
you'll have to be very pithy.
Yeah, well, all I would say is that while I will go to the mat for anyone to defend the First Amendment, I think it has been shredded by bloggers, not just because a lot of them are so foul-mouthed and often just completely ignorant, but because they tend to be often very, very vicious and negative. And I find that the libels are let go right onto the Internet, are impossible to get down. I will say overall restaurant criticism and writing has gotten just phenomenally better over the last 20, 30 years.
I still find that people, because I did that restaurant criticism thing for a long time, mm-hmm. and I find that people still value what I say as opposed to something they find in social media.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I don't think that it's eroded that much, to be honest.
Well, it's eroding, I think. You know, we still have the Ruth Reichels and the Coleman Andrews and many others, and the newspapers certainly have a lot of very good writers, but the blogosphere is, I think, is frightening. And unfortunately, restaurateurs take it so seriously that they get some foul-mouthed person who says, I'm going to tell 1,000 of my readers. They get very, very concerned about that.
Yeah, well, there's not much they can do to stop it.
There's every reason. But it reminds me of an encounter with Drew Napourant on a panel, and Drew was holding forth about the scum called
critics,
called dining critics, mm-hmm. and so I asked him a question. I said, "It seems to me, Drew, that you're saying that there are no bad restaurants, and there are no good dining critics." And I said, "I'm here to tell you that I know one very well, and I know she takes her job extraordinarily seriously." And everybody sort of laughed. And I think Anne said that she went to the ladies' room afterwards, and somebody said, "Who was that guy who spoke up?" And she was kind enough to say, "That's my husband coming to my rescue."
Yeah. So.
Well, I remember Drew one certainly thinks there are bad restaurants, because he will tell you exactly which ones he thinks they are, but I remember he once got a one-star review for one of his restaurants, which wasn't a very good restaurant years ago, and the one-star from the New York Times, and he said, "John, do I open one-star restaurants?" And I said, "Well, in this case, Drew, maybe you did." And he was out of business in 6 months. Nobody liked it.
Yeah, well, he got really upset with Amanda Hesser, though, and so when we were interviewing her about her book, I said, "I think we can thank you for Corton."
Maybe so, yeah.
That, and one other thing is, do you have any comments on your raging battle with Grant Achatz?
Well, my raging battle with Grant Achatz basically has to do with the fact that I never wrote a negative word about him, but because I never wrote a positive one either, he felt snubbed.
You think that's what it is, yes. Yeah.
I mean, he didn't make it into my 20 Best New Restaurants of the Year in Esquire that year when he opened, and from there on he was looking for an opportunity to attack, as he did Frank Bruni of the New York Times, as he did Charlie Trotta. So, I mean, there are just certain people like that who need to get a life and pass
on. Well, why did Bourdain jump into the mess?
Oh, he's just the junkyard dog of the media. He excoriates everybody, and including himself. I mean, this is the remarkable thing, is that he's probably said worse things about himself than he has about most of his colleagues, and I'm just so fed up with his tirades that last time he attacked me, I said in print or in the media, I said, "Dear Anthony, let's have a drink. I'm buying. Let's get this behind us." Never heard from him.
Isn't that funny?
Well, the world is full of exciting things like Jamie Oliver dressing up as a giant tomato.
I saw that.
Well, we could go on about this.
Oh, yeah, this is fun talking to you, John.
Let's come back to the subject of what was supposed to be the subject of this interview, how Italian food conquered the world. The wonderful part about this, I think you would be quick to say, is that this is only the beginning of the story.
Well,
and
so.
And you end because you had to finish the book.
Right.
But what's happening with the next release of this book? What's going to be in there, do you think?
Well, if I write a revision of this book 10 years from now, I would say that Italian food will be easily as popular and probably more so around the world. I don't think it's peaked, and it's become just a category, meaning that if you and I went to an American restaurant now, we would find charcuterie on it. It would be French, but it might be Italian.
Salumi.
Burrata cheese. There's going to be a section that has little pizzas or flatbread pizzas. And it's unquestionably going to have a whole section on the menu of pasta. So this is not just conquering the world, but now it's just a set part of any menu outside of Asian.
Well, we appreciate your taking the time to join us today on the menu, John. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
And bon voyage. You're always moving.
Yeah, we can't wait for the next installment.
Well, the pleasure's been all mine, gang.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And now a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we're back now, and I have to admit that I've pretty much fell in love with our next guest, Lou DiPaolo. What a wonderful man and a poet about Italian food, especially cheese.
And you'll hear the story of how his family's brought the very best in Italian products to his store in Little Italy and accessible to you via the wonders of ordering over the internet and fulfillment the same way. So this is not just something you can hear about, it's something you can enjoy for yourselves, and I'm sure you'll enjoy our conversation with Lou.
Yes, welcome to On the Menu, Lou DiPaolo. You certainly have fine foods, and that's the name of your store, DiPaolo's Fine Foods, and they're Italian products. You also have an online company, which is DiPaoloSelects.com. Is that correct?
That's right, and you know, our shop originally was named C. DiPaolo, after my grandmother, Concetta DiPaolo.
Oh, Concetta, that's a wonderful
name. Yes, we're proud to say that we're here in New York City's Little Italy for over 100 years. We're one of the oldest families of Little Italy. And my great-grandfather, Savino DiPaolo, he emigrated from Basilicata, Italy.
Oh, from Basilicata, huh?
Yes, from Basilicata. And southern Italy, you know, it's the instep of Italy.
Yes, we've been there.
Think of Italy as a boot. Uh-huh. It's the instep.
No, we know the province well. We were in, we bypassed Matera. We didn't go to the caves in Matera, but we crossed Basilicata going east and then again going west.
Okay, so you crisscrossed it, but you didn't stop to see any of the wonderful products that Basilicata has to offer?
No, we knew we could get them at DiPaolo, so we didn't have to.
Absolutely, for sure. Being the region of our heritage, we make sure that we have an adequate supply of the fine pasta, olive oil, and unique cheeses that Basilicata has to offer.
But you're doing that for the whole of Italy now, too.
Yes, right? Yes. You know, when my great-grandfather came here, he brought his tradition. He was a cheesemaker / farmer in the hills of Basilicata in the town of Monte Milone. And he opened up a small latteria. A latteria is a dairy, a place where he made his fresh mozzarella and ricotta and cacciotta, scamorza. These are cheeses that he made all by hand. And in 1925, my grandparents, with the encouragement of my great-grandfather, Savino DiPaolo, opened up their latteria, their dairy, sold milk out of a milk can, their fresh cheeses. And as the generations went on, as my father and my uncle continued the business right after World War II, they increased the product line to carry some of the food products of Italy, primarily from southern Italy, products that were able to withstand temperature change and travel through sea voyages, such as hard cheeses as Pecorino Romano and Provolone, and some olive oil, Caciocavallo. But it wasn't until my brother Sal, my sister Marie, and myself continued the business in the late 70s that we started to really increase the product line to represent all 20 regions of Italy. We're proud to say we have over 300 cheeses of Italy represented at DiPaolo's, but a host of other products, estate olive oils, fine vinegars, pastas, unique pastas from the different regions, such as Pici from Tuscany and Trofia from Liguria, Strascinata from Basilicata from my hometown, my area. So DiPaolo's now, although we haven't lost sight of the fact that we are still an Italian dairy, a latteria, where we manufacture our fresh dairy every day, 7 days a week, fresh mozzarella. And
so you're still doing that?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Okay,
and, you know, in fact, we put every now and then we put some video clips on our website.
Right.
And, in fact, one of the sites right now is featuring myself showing you how we make fresh mozzarella.
Yes.
And the tradition of it, how it's handmade and how it's best to be enjoyed. So I've made frequent trips to Italy over the years to discover new products from Italy, new old products, products that have a history and tradition that goes back for centuries, but products that haven't been really available here in the U.S. and try to establish them here in the United States, not only to be sold in my retail shop, but to encourage other places throughout the United States to handle some of these unique and wonderful products that Italy has to offer. I try to promote authentic products of Italy. Yes, of course, I make my own cheese. I make in the Italian style our fresh dairy. But at the same time, we're proud to also offer fresh mozzarella di bufala, for instance. The fresh mozzarella made in the tradition with the water buffalo milk from the region of Campania and a little bit of Lazio, in the area of Latina.
You must get that over here pretty quickly, though.
Yes, yes. Today, with air freight, we're able to get it within a few days of its production. For me, fresh mozzarella means made the same day. Practically, it's not possible to have a product like that from Italy produced the same day and then sold the same day in the United States. But within a few days, it can happen. And we have fresh burrata. Burrata is another fresh dairy. We make it, and we also have it imported from Italy. And we'll only sell it for a few days a week because it's extremely perishable. And we like to present the authentic product and, of course, give the American consumer the option to have our version, our traditional product that we make here in our shop in New York.
Now, you've got a secret somewhere. I don't know what it is, and I don't know if you'll give it away. But the cheeses that you sent us were so magnificently kept. I mean,
well,
it was like buying them at the dairy that produced them in Italy.
One thing we take a lot of pride in, we want to present the products the way it's meant to be enjoyed. For instance, our fresh Gorgonzola. Gorgonzola Dolce is a cheese that's made, aged for approximately 55 to 60 days. It's at its best between 60 and 75 days. So now, if we're going to bring that in by boat, which takes approximately 14 days, already you're at its maximum life. So a cheese like that, we need to fly in. Sure, the cost is considerably more, but when consumer comes in and tastes our Gorgonzola, they take two steps back and say, this Gorgonzola is so delicate, so sweet, so very, very enjoyable. Never harsh, never offensive aroma, and it's the way the product is supposed to be enjoyed. And we take a lot of pride in discovering it. You know, when I travel to Italy, it's not just to go and meet the people in Italy and walk around and see the different products that they have. I need to meet the farmer. I need to see the animals that the milk comes from, how they're treated, and then take it to the next level, to the cheesemaker. Not necessarily the owner of the company. I need to meet the cheesemaker, the Maestro Cassaro, see his passion, understand, and learn from him how his product should be enjoyed. And now, take that knowledge back to the United States and give the same knowledge to all who has the desire to learn about it. And in this way, they can go home, share that knowledge with their family, enjoy the products together. One thing we're going to assure all our customers, that the products that we sell them is the products that are meant to be in that particular condition and to be enjoyed at a certain period of time, of course.
Now, you're doing enough volume, I guess, that you bring in cheese, you bring in whole cheeses too, right? So you're able to take care of them properly, essentially from the cheesemaker to yourselves.
It's very, very important. You need to have a good understanding of one particular product, one particular cheese, its life, its temperature that it needs to be, its humidity that it needs to be kept at. And this way, we can maintain the actual texture and freshness for the consumer. And then we try to educate and teach our consumers how best to store the product so that they may keep it for a reasonable amount of time. My attitude is always, please buy what you're going to consume
exactly.
within a reasonable amount of time, because a good piece of cheese or a good piece of salumi is living, and it has a certain life. It needs proper care and to enjoy it. And of course, to get the maximum enjoyment out of something, you want to enjoy it when it's at its best.
You have a specialty in Grana Padano, see?
Well, see, Grana Padano in the United States has always been a cheese that was not known. There was no product identity for Grana Padano. Grana Padano is an historic cheese of Italy. It has a history of over 1,000 years. It was first made by Cistercian monks that reclaimed extremely fertile land that was laid to waste after a barbarian invasion in the year 400. And using the animal, the cow, as a beast of burden to re-plow the swampy lands over and make them fertile again, they had a lot of milk. And they turned that milk into a cheese that was able to stand the test of time, a cheese that would be able to last for literally years. And that was the birth of this wonderful cheese, Grana. And it gets its name, Grana Padano, from the word Padano, meaning of the Po. There's this river basically cuts Italy in half. Not in half, but it cuts right through
the right.
northern part of Italy, the Po River. And north of the Po is where you have this very rich, fertile lands. And it goes from Piemonte to parts of Emilia-Romagna, Lombardia, Veneto. And this very rich, lush, fertile grazing areas is where they get the milk for Grana Padano.
Now, and people get it confused with Parmigiano-Reggiano.
Parmigiano-Reggiano.
Yeah.
Well, Parmigiano-Reggiano is another historic cheese of Italy.
But this is not the same.
No, because there's two main. It's basically made in the same way with two very, very important differences. One is the location where the milk is coming from. There's a unique rolling hills of Emilia-Romagna where 95% of the Parmigiano-Reggiano is produced. These beautiful country breezes in the areas of Parma, Reggio Emilia, Modena, Bologna, these are different sections, and a little bit of Mantova, south of the Mantova being in Lombardia, south of the Po River. These country grazing lands has a unique characteristic. That is the characteristic of Parmigiano-Reggiano, coupled with the fact that Parmigiano-Reggiano is made primarily once a day from two milkings. See, cows, they give milk twice a day.
Right.
And in the morning, when they milk the cow in the morning, it's the full fat milk. But when they milk the cow at night and they let it stand through the night, or in the evening, and they let the milk stand through the night, the cream rises. They skim off the cream, and now they have a skimmed milk, partially skimmed milk, blended with the whole milk of the morning, and they'll use that to make Parmigiano. That milk will be used to make Parmigiano-Reggiano.
That's really interesting.
Is only skimmed milk.
Okay.
And they can make Grana twice a day because of the morning milk. They allow it to stand in the afternoon, skim off the fat, and making their Grana Padano. And the evening milk, let it stand overnight, the cream rises, skim it off, and make Grana Padano in the morning. The abundance of milk is much greater in the areas above the Po because of that rich, fertile area. So they're able to do a much larger quantity. And the difference between the two cheeses, Grana Padano tends to be a little bit more delicate, sweet. Parmigiano tends to be a little bit more rich and intense in flavor. But both have the characteristics of being what we call a Grana cheese,
right.
made by breaking the curds down into small little pieces the size of a grain. Hence we get the name Grana. And when the cheese ages and we open the cheese, we usually crack it. We score it, and then we crack the cheese rather than cut it.
Oh, that's
you'll notice
it looks,
that it'll
yes.
have a lot of grainy look to it.
Right. I didn't
and
know that.
So
yeah.
we get the name Grana from the family of cheese is called Grana, and it's either Grana Padano or Grana Parmigiano-Reggiano.
Okay.
So that's the family of cheese, both with their own significant history. One shouldn't be confused with the other. In fact, in my house, I often have both cheeses. I like to use them for different types of dishes. For instance, up in the mountains of Valtellina, that's the northern part of Lombardia, you have a wonderful cured beef. It's called brisaola. Air-dried beef. What pork is to prosciutto, beef is to brisaola. We slice that very, very thin. It's very delicate. And then we usually shave some grana padano on top of it, adding a very delicate olive oil, and we have a wonderful combination. Most of the time I layer a bit of rucola right on the
bottom. Right, I was going to say you're missing the rucola.
No, yeah. No, he's not missing it.
But truthfully...
You're making me hungry, Lou.
Truthfully, you could take the bresaola and shave the grana, add a little bit of olive oil, and just roll the bresaola and just serve it like little rolls of cured beef as a finger food rather than a salad.
Now, how come I don't have any bresaola so I can do that?
Bresaola is one of the gifts of northern Italy and Switzerland.
Yeah, but
Switzerland, they'll call it a little different. They'll call it.
Do you know this much about all of your ingredients? I mean, you are a walking encyclopedia.
Well, I've made my life and enjoyed every moment of it, learning and understanding about the foods and the traditions of Italy through the foods of Italy.
Wow.
And there's many wonderful products that Italy has to offer to us. I feel it's one of the greatest contributions that not only my family but Italian immigrants brought to this country was food. Italians, they live to eat. We in America so often eat to live, although Americans now are discovering the wonderful benefits of sitting down and enjoying a wonderful meal, whether it is an Italian meal or a Mexican meal or French, but to understand and savor. And you could see it through all the wonderful programs that TV shows. Some of them, of course, might promote less than food, but still desire to learn and understand about the different cultural foods is making our country and the people of our country much more sophisticated people at the dinner table. I feel the Italians have a big played a big role in achieving that in the United States.
You know, Lou, we shop markets and find stores like yours all over Italy. It's like I know what your shop smells like, even though I haven't been there.
We have. If you ever enter into Di Paolo's, you're going to enter into a place with
wonderful odors.
Cheese is all over. Aging. Even our windows are aging rooms where we temperature control them, you know, and there'll be literally thousands of pounds of cheese aging while the people in the environment of shopping. And it's you're literally visiting either the cheesemaker or the cheese affinatore, or the person who ages and alters the cheese. So
now, where exactly is your shop?
We're located in New York City's Little Italy. We're on the corner of Mott and Grand Street, and the address is 200 Grand Street.
If you
can visit my shop literally by going to my website.
I was going to suggest that next.
.com, and you can actually enter into the shop and see different times of maybe whether we're serving some people or, you know, with the videos, and you get a sense of how people come in, and they're very patient. We have the most patient customers, I think, in the world, where they'll come in and they'll understand that when their turn comes up, they're like the only customer in the place, and we're going to spend a lot of time to explain and help them understand the products that they're purchasing. And you find so often that people have become friends in my place. They just by waiting and discussing what they're going to buy, the different products that they're buying, and sharing among the customers. It becomes a very, almost like family-orientated type of environment.
Lou, all I can say is we wish you were closer when we're in New York City if we have the chance.
I want to be a part of your family.
Well, you know, we often say if you come into our place, you'll notice that our counters are waist-high. All our counters are marble, and of course Carrara marble because it's from Italy. And it represents a table, and they're waist high. So you're walking up to the counter. It's as if you're basically sitting at a table. And we're not only you're purchasing the food, but we're sharing, we like to think we're sharing our food with you. And it's an extension of our home. And it's an experience. It literally is an experience to come in and shop in our place. And I know from literally over the years, the thousands of letters that we've received from customers that have come in and have experienced shopping at Di Paolo's, you'll always find a family member there. I mean, we're into our fifth generation.
Wow.
Our children work alongside us. My sister Marie, my brother Sal, and myself are there all the time. At least one of us, but usually all three of us are there. And we're just very, very proud of it. And my father, going back in the 30s, he was very much into photography, and he went out and he got himself an old movie camera. He took some old movie films, and we even show those films of my grandmother and my father when he was very young, and my uncle, and how they work. And you want to know, things haven't changed. If you could see the way we are serving a customer, the way they were serving a customer, and it almost amazes me to look back and say, gee, did we improve the business, or did we just stay the same? And you know, the answer is our business has continued because we looked to the past. And by looking to the past, we took giant steps into the future.
Well, Lou, you're to be congratulated. And,
well, thank you.
And we thank you for sharing these thoughts with us today. We thank you for the delightful cheese, which we are very much enjoying.
Absolutely,
so,
my pleasure.
So we know you know what you're doing, and we also know that listeners getting a shipment by Federal Express or UPS from a store in New York might not sound like a good idea. I can assure you that the product arrives in absolutely wonderful condition. And you'll enjoy it.
We have to thank my niece Jessica because she takes a lot of pride in making sure that not only when an order comes in, it's cut that day and shipped out that day. Everything is cut, hand cut, and packed, and within hours sent out so that people would receive it as if they had just purchased it in our shop.
Well, Lou, when we're next in New York, we'll come to our shop. But could I wrangle an invitation for Sunday dinner too? At your house.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay, so anyhow, thank you so much, Lou.
Well, thank you.
Until I see you.
Okay.
And now it's time for another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Wake up, and welcome back.
I'm here.
Oh, she's here. Yeah. She's gonna let me say something for once.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about our next guest. We've known him for so many years.
Yeah, Rosario Safina is always coming up with something to do with truffles.
Yes, he's like Mr. Truffle. But I mean, his latest product he's going to talk about, it's called Knock Your Socks Off. Truffle mayo. Anyhow, let's listen to Rosario and see what he's up to now. Every so often, we like to catch up with the Rosario Safina because he's always on to something new. And boy, you sent us a knockout new product. I should mention, by the way, Rosario, that your company is called
Da Rosario Organic.
You've been at this for a long time. I sort of question your sanity of choosing such a crazy career, but at any rate, you've been at this a while, and your latest product has really got our attention, although we've worked together before, and that was truffle mayonnaise. It's killer, absolute killer.
And we do it, it's USDA certified organic white truffle mayonnaise and USDA certified organic black winter truffle mayonnaise.
Well, now, I've never heard this before. You included me in some kind of an email. Are you the only one doing this?
We're the only ones that produce a fresh white truffle and black truffle mayonnaise that's USDA certified organic, that's made with real truffles.
You see, this is the thing that I always depend on you to tell me about. I really hate, I mean, you find chefs using this, I don't know what it is, it's some chemical composition that's supposed to be truffle oil. And it doesn't taste like truffles to me at all. It tastes like chemicals.
Well, it always goes back to the fact is that most people, I would think 99.9% of the people in this country, never had fresh truffles. So they really don't know what it should taste like. And what ends up happening is, through the magic of chemistry, a product was produced out there back in 1981, and they called it truffle oil. And it was marketed as being the flavor of truffles, and so the consumer, and the chefs in particular, believed it because they never really tasted fresh truffles.
It does smell like truffles.
I always think it smells something like truffles. And, you know, that's always got to be taken with a grain of salt. You know, does it smell like white truffles? Does it smell like black truffles? You know, does it smell like black winter truffles?
But it does have an odor that's genuine, and I guess that's produced chemically.
Yeah, that's an organic chemical compound is what it is.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what they use on tennis balls to train the dogs to get the truffles in Australia.
Well, you know, it's synthetic chemical compound.
Exactly.
It's not taken from a fresh truffle.
And it tastes synthetic.
It's one of the natural chemical profiles of a truffle. You know, there's 35, 40 different natural chemical profiles that make up a truffle. And they just synthesized one of those compounds.
Okay, so they've got the olfactory sensation in a way, but nothing like the flavor.
Correct. And, you know, it doesn't have the complexity, it doesn't have the different levels, it doesn't have that, I always say, the full figure of the fresh white or black truffle.
Your mayonnaises. One of the things that we found out, in fact, I think I owe this information to Dr. Nick in Manjimup in Western Australia. He said one of the difficulties with truffle oils, and I'm wondering if the same is true with truffle mayonnaise, is that the truffle is only stable for a certain length of time. So your shelf life, you have to be careful with your shelf life. Now, would that apply to your mayonnaise as well?
An interesting fact about all of our truffle products is that once you open it up and start working with it, you have to finish the product.
Okay.
You know, our product, I always say, shelf stable according to the best buy date, close. When you open it and start to use our products, you can't leave them around for 4, 5, 6 months. They really, really start to lose their flavor.
Right. Now, what lifespan once opened then of the mayonnaise, which you sent us small samples, I'm guessing it comes in a small jar like the truffle butters?
Yes, it comes in a 2.5-ounce container, plastic container that's refrigerated.
Okay, and that would be good for how long then?
Say once you open it up, you got to use it within the month.
Okay, and the same would apply to the truffle butters as well?
Truffle butters, I would say the same thing, 4 to 6 weeks. I would say truffle oils within 4 weeks. Our truffle seasonings within 6 weeks.
Yeah, you have truffle and salt, but...
Yes, that we call our seasonings.
Okay.
And the same thing with our truffle honey. I would think once you open the jar, you got to use it between 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, otherwise it's just going to fade. Slowly but surely it's going to fade, right?
Slowly but surely it will dissipate.
Now, let's while we're on the subject of that then, let's work on how people can get access to your product line. Are you in stores, or do you do exclusively mail order, or both?
If you go to our blog post, darrosario.com, you could see the list of our retailers. We don't sell direct to the public, but you see our web retailers.
Okay, great.
And our retail locations.
Murray Cheese,
That's always listed and kept pretty current. People can also email me to ask, you know, like in their own town in particular, what retailer might carry it.
So you can get fulfillment over someone who's doing fine grocery products online, or you can get it in stores, and the best way to find out is get in touch with you?
That's correct, yeah.
Now, you sell real truffles, I mean fresh truffles too, right?
I always say that, you know, a lot of times you see these truffle companies selling truffle products, and they actually don't do any fresh truffles, which I always find very strange. but we also do a lot of fresh truffles. You know, I've been doing fresh truffles all my life, and still to this day we sell lots of fresh truffles from the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere.
Back to my original question is, why would you, it's so fraught with stress, dissembling, and mystery, and why would you pick a career in truffles? I mean, you've even written a book about truffles, the definitive book about truffles.
It was always a major attraction, cooking wise for me. First started, it was in advertising. I was doing direct marketing, and I had an Italian mail order food catalog on the side. One of the items was truffles in it, and it was just jarred truffles. And met this company at the time that was producing the jarred truffles, and I just became very intrigued with it. You know, how this particular wild product was able to capture. You know, the imagination and the taste of so many different people. And it all started from then. And, you know, and then the truffles then led to the wild mushrooms. And, you know, I just find it so interesting.
So you still do wild mushrooms too?
Yes, and I still do wild mushrooms. We do those only wholesale. And, you know, we do large volumes of it. you know, to major distributors.
Now, you're doing, your truffles are coming from, you said from Australia, where we met the two guys that you know who are producing there, one in Tasmania and the other in Western Australia.
Right. And you're also truffle fresh in, you know, July and in August. And now, you know, that's a 6-week, 8-week season for their fresh black winter truffles.
And then you're getting
Chile as well.
You're getting your truffle supply from Europe, from Italy. I think
yes.
You said Umbria.
That's correct. We have land in a cooperative that's USDA certified organic, and that's where we get our fresh truffles that are USDA certified organic that go into our truffle production. And that's the only truffle that we use in our organic truffle production.
Right.
And those truffles we don't sell fresh. Those truffles, when they're available, it goes into making all of our USDA-certified organic base ingredients.
Well, everybody's been fiddling around trying to grow truffles for decades now. Why is it so impossible to get decent truffles produced here in this country?
I actually think it's because of lack of expertise. There's only one company that really produces real truffles, and that's by Dr. Tom Michaels in Tennessee. And that's because he's a real doctor. He has a PhD in food sciences and mycology. A lot of the other companies, I always look at them, and you know, they all say they're producing truffles, and it's like, who's behind it? I wonder how. I mean, if you don't have a PhD in mycology and you don't have a PhD in agriculture, how do you do these things?
Right now, the doctor Nick in Western Australia, he's like that. He's been at it for 20 years or so, and he's an agronomist. He's an agricultural scientist. He's exactly what he is.
If you take a look at the people who do all these truffle plantations here in the United States, I think you can count all on one hand who actually has a PhD in agricultural sciences or a PhD in mycology.
I wanted to ask you another question. It's out of the blue. I should have mentioned it before we came on the air. But, the French, of course, claim that Perigord truffles are the original truffles. But I was talking to someone, I can't remember who it was, and they said, you know, Peter, quite a large percentage of the truffles produced in France are now farmed.
It's about 40% of the crop.
Okay, it's about 40%. So I suppose that person was not misleading me.
No, in Italy, France, and Spain, well, Spain is even higher. Spain is probably 65-70% because of the Arroz plantation. Yeah, that's the biggest producing plantation in the world.
Where is that?
That's in it's north of Soria in central Spain.
Okay.
Maybe 3-4 hours north of Madrid.
Heading towards the Rioja wine region, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Is there a difference? Well, obviously, there's a difference, but how different is a certified organic, naturally grown truffle and one that's produced from a farm?
There really is no difference.
There really is, no, okay.
You know, the only difference is, you know, when you were just said before about, you know, France having the original black winter truffle, Tuber melanosporum, you know, scientifically speaking, Tuber melanosporum, wherever it comes from, if that's the species, that's what it is. Then when it comes down to flavor and aroma, you know, those are all characteristics of the soil and then the environment that the truffles grow in. You know, people always used to, you know, during the fresh black winter truffle season, people always used to say, you know, truffles from France are better than the ones from Italy, better than the ones from Spain. You know, they're all the same species, and depending upon the climate and the earth is what actually produces the flavor. You know, I remember on several occasions, you know, there were times when the truffles in Spain were better than the ones in France and in Italy, and the ones in Italy were better. You know, it just depends upon, you know, the season. And the ground.
And the quality of the farming to some extent, I guess, too, right?
Well, that's always the case.
Yeah.
But if you're farming, if your cultivation is any good, you probably just won't get any truffles.
Well, while I have you here, though, sure. I wanted to ask you what the next big thing that we might expect from truffles in the truffle market.
I mean, the next big thing is what we just came out with, which is the
mayo.
Organic white and truffle mayo. Mayo is the country's number one condiment.
I never realized that.
Yes,
when it comes
beats
to food service and to table service, it's the number one condiment.
Yeah, it beats ketchup.
It beats ketchup. And that's because, you know, mayonnaise is used in a lot of different salad preparations and in a lot of table service. Ketchup and the other, and salsa really aren't used that much in food preparation.
Right.
You know, whether you're making potato salad or coleslaw or any other seafood salad.
Well, Rosaria, we wish you great success with this product. It's lovely. I just spread it on fresh bread.
Did you?
Smell it and eat it at the same time, and it's just absolutely delicious.
Rosaria, can I tell you, he steals all the things that you send.
He's
devoured the butter. He's eaten mayo.
I haven't devoured it. I've used a little bit of it.
Well, anyway. I always say with the mayo, if you just do a simple roast turkey sandwich with the white truffle mayo,
if
you do a roast beef sandwich with the black truffle mayo, it really comes out special.
Well, let's do that website one more time before we say goodbye.
DonRosario.com.
Okay, that shouldn't be too difficult for you to spelled linguistically. That's absolutely fine. Rosario, once again, a pleasure to talk to you.
It's good being friends for so long, Rosario.
I'll have to send you some more samples just to your attention. Okay.
Thank you so much, and keep us up to date with what you're doing.
All right. Thanks a lot. Take care now.
Thank you. Well, it's always nice catching up with Rosario, I guess.
And catching up with John and catching up with Lou. Quite a program today.
Right.
We hope you enjoyed it, and you'll join us again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.